So an unpopular opinion should be like, computers were a mistake. Was was this all worth it?
Welcome to DevDiscuss, the show where we cover the burning topics that impact all our lives as developers. I'm Ben Halpern, co-founder of Dev.
And I'm Jess Lee, also a co-founder of Dev. Today we're talking about unpopular tech opinions with Google staff developer advocate Kelsey Hightower. Many of you may know Kelsey through his contributions in the Kubernetes ecosystem. Kelsey, thanks for joining us today.
Awesome to be here.
We thought you'd be a really good guest on this show. We just kind of had the idea that this topic was kind of up your alley from, you know, what we've seen about you on the internet. But do you want to tell us a little bit about your background in general?
Yeah, I started in tech maybe about 15 years ago, big operations background. And around the midway point, I made the transition to software development through Puppet Labs, you know, doing co-contributions to the open source configuration management project. And I guess since then, there's been a few enterprise stops along the way, but now I'm at Google working in cloud, trying to help people adopt all of these kind of open source technologies, including things like Kubernetes.
Can you tell us what a staff developer advocate does?
I have no idea. Right. So the HR titles are kind of funny. So I guess internally, I'm at the director level, and there's some executive work that we do in terms of diversity and inclusion, retaining, growing talent. And on the outside world, a lot of people know me for giving talks and keynotes, but I also do a lot of product work and prototyping. So a combination of all of those things, including helping our customers kind of adopt what we're building, goes into it. So you could say a developer advocate traditionally is someone who attempts to advocate for the people we serve.
Are there any projects that you're working on right now that you're particularly excited about?
I think all the tech stuff is kind of cool. Like in the last 5 to 10 years, there's been this rethinking about how we build distributed systems and how we share ideas around them. So this whole Kubernetes cloud native space where we're starting to standardize some of the practices different companies have been engaged in, and we're sharing it through tangible open source projects. The things that motivate me the most, though, are things like serverless, right? This idea that a lot of people can focus on building and shipping applications and not necessarily managing infrastructure. And I think we have that in some areas like DNS and email, but I'm really anxious for serverless to provide that same thing for general compute.
Yeah, serverless seems like one of those sort of things that transition from unpopular opinion to popular opinion, sort of like gained the sort of best practice ethos like just recently, I think, maybe in some fields.
Yeah, you could say, depending on the circle, if you're maybe talking to an operations-specific crowd, I think it's still an unpopular opinion, and for good reason. There's a lot of lack of trust in terms of, will that serverless offering be there when you need it most? Can it run all the workloads you need it to run? And the answer to any of those is no. You're going to have a lot of people who will resist and continue to desire to run and manage their own infrastructure.
So as a developer advocate, I think part of your job is to be opinionated and to sort of help form the opinions of developers all around. What's your sort of big picture thought about, like, you know, unpopular opinions in tech? Like, what is being missed, like why an opinion that you think is valid is sort of unpopular, stuff like that?
Yeah, so I think anyone that's building, right, if you are writing code or building a product or you're a CTO or a founder, there's a bit of advocacy that's part of your job, right? Getting people to understand what you're building, why you're building it, and then to establish that feedback loop so that they can tell you what they need from that thing. And when it comes to unpopular opinions, it's really based on, like, there's like cargo culting, or some people would describe this as best practices, right? This is what the majority of the people are doing. So I'm just going to do that regardless if I understand what that is. Anything that goes against that could be considered a unpopular opinion.
So Kelsey, you're a person with opinions, many of them good. And I'm really excited to hear which of your opinions you think are the most unpopular.
I think the ones that are most unpopular right now, especially where I'm involved in like the whole Kubernetes world, right? So the Kubernetes community has been optimizing for microservices architectures. Same thing for things like service mesh, right? Things that will allow you to do things like traffic management, identity management for your applications. Both of those tools have the most value when you have lots of applications to deploy. In my holding, though, mentally, I think most companies are not quite ready to adopt a microservices architecture. And that's a very unpopular opinion in my core community because microservices have so many perceived benefits. And a lot of the stuff that we're working on is to help make microservices easier to adopt. But I still push back and say, look, microservices come with a tremendous amount of overhead. And most companies should consider building what will be traditionally described as monolithic applications and get really good at that before considering a new architecture pattern that may come with a lot more requirements than what they're currently doing.
Can we actually quickly define microservices versus monoliths, just for our audience who might not be so familiar?
I guess if you're an engineering background, there are only services. That's all there is. You can have one big service that does a lot of things, like a calculator app, may be able to add, subtract, divide, authenticate people that want to use the calculator. And for the most intense purposes, that's a service. Just happens to do a lot of things. There's one school of thought that says having all of those services in a single deployable artifact could be considered a monolithic service, right? Everything is baked in there. And it presents some challenges, meaning if you have a bunch of developers, they all have to figure out how to get their code to play nice in that one deployable. And it may also constrain the number of technologies that can be used, right? Like if you pick Ruby as your programming language, then all the other services will have to use Ruby as well because they're going to have to tie in at the code level. And then microservices, I'm not sure anyone can define this correctly, but someone thinking about services from the microservices lens would say, hey, maybe we should split out add, subtract, division, and authentication into their own deployables. And then that will give us the ability to pick different programming languages for each of those particular services. And in that case, you would say, maybe now I go from one deployable to four, and now I have a set of microservices. They're smaller in scope, and I can iterate on them at different speeds. But at the end of the day, they're all services. It's just the way you think about them architecturally.
Yeah, we're a Ruby shop over here. And as a small startup, we are working with a monolith, but we're not afraid to break out certain things. What sort of advice do you have for folks on like when they might want to consider working with microservices?
Honestly, I think it's more of you'll know when the time is right, right? Like most people will start with everything kind of in maybe a single deployable, one big service that does multiple things. And when it makes sense, maybe you're doing some new functionality that just has nothing to do with that big service that you have. Great. Break it out. That might be the most natural thing to do. Background jobs, cron jobs, file processing, a lot of those services easily can live standalone. So I think most people know when it feels right because it seems like the obvious thing to do. And going in the other direction, stuffing all of that stuff in the single service that you have starts to feel a little bit unnatural, and it feels like you're forcing things where they don't belong.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's how we've had to think about it. Like, what is the purpose? What is the organization of our code, our community? Like, what are we sort of trying to get out of this? You know, to us, we've leaned in. We've actually tried to kind of lately go as more monolithic than even before, just to kind of organize things like as they've kind of played out. Definitely see, you know, our entire code base is open source. So we get a lot of like opinions coming in and stuff. Occasionally we'll get this like notion that everything we're doing is wrong because it's not like thinking in terms of microservices. And we can't like, you know, totally debate the criticisms in and of themselves, but we sort of have to know that like we're sort of on a journey and we have like sort of an identity and a way we do things, and we sort of have to do them kind of how we do them. It's so contextual, and that's why you sort of need these different opinions and you need to sort of be opinionated about what you're doing.
All right. So I think it's important to pull on the thread of why something like this would be considered unpopular. A lot of people are already actually doing this kind of opinion already, right? And most people will feel that their infrastructure is either A, not working, or it's not as good as it could be. So when someone says the thing that I'm not doing is probably a best practice, it seems to be very obvious, like, oh yeah, something other than what I'm doing is where I should be going. And if I come and say, nope, the thing you're currently doing is probably a good fit for you, the problem lies elsewhere. That's what makes this unpopular.
Yeah, like there's no silver bullet. Kind of like it's the hard pill to swallow is that this isn't going to solve your problems.
Or may make worse problems that you didn't account for. And then you'll deal with a whole another set of unpopular opinions because you took maybe the wrong direction.
Jess, what unpopular opinions do you carry?
So I think that code can repeat itself and that you don't always have to be dry, and dry stands for don't repeat yourself. I think that sometimes people take it a little bit too far. And yeah, I think that people just shouldn't be afraid to repeat their code sometimes, because sometimes it's just necessary. One of my favorite quotes that sort of like clicked, made it all click for me, was from Sandy Metz. And she says, like, you know, duplication is cheaper than the wrong abstraction. And that just, yeah, resonates true with me. What do you two think?
Yeah, I think there's limits, right? If I see a code base where the same function is copied 5,000 times and I have to update each of those, I might say, wow, right, that's we probably crossed a line somewhere. But I do agree with you that you see this represent itself the worst when people import third-party dependencies. When all you really needed was, you know, read a file from disk, but you import a 1 million line file abstraction library, now you're starting to get into that dangerous area where you try to remain dry at the expense of a large dependency.
Ben, what are some of your unpopular opinions?
I'm going to say that being on the bleeding edge or on brand new technology is usually a pretty bad decision and is kind of to be avoided unless you absolutely need to be. I think that's influenced a lot of our choices in terms of like just being on stuff that's been around for a while and gradually adopting new things.
And my guess, the reason why it's unpopular is because, like, for example, COVID-19, right? We're all struggling through this pandemic. And you have, I think it's the state of New Jersey saying, hey, we have this 60-year-old code base that we can't find anyone to come work on it. And I guess some people feel that if you're not staying on top of what's coming out, whether it's on the bleeding edge or just newer than what you have, you run the risk of doing this call for action 60 years later, looking for people to work on your tried and true technology.
Kelsey, will you hit us with another unpopular opinion?
Oh, this idea that you will have your own data center, your company will have its own data center, and be able to buy servers and rack them and install operating systems and patch them and do whatever you want will one day go away.
Which type of companies do you think would be the last to let that go?
I think the last companies would be like your ISPs, Comcast, your Netflixes of the world who stream a bunch of data. They'll need the ability to control their own destiny. And in some cases, having their own footprint closer to their customer base makes a lot of sense. But that's not necessarily the same as having a full-on data center where you run all your applications. The larger companies in the world would be, you know, some of the big, big brands that you see. But if you're a bank, most retailers, you know, smaller businesses, which kind of dominate, at least in the U.S., all of those probably wouldn't be a good fit. You can also see governments even moving in this direction. So if you think about like the stock exchange or some of these shared services that we have in our lives, those kind of represent a place where people can actually transact and do work without necessarily having to replicate that on their own.
Is there anyone in the sort of cloud ecosystem that would disagree with this? Like, is this something where you're going to get in one group of people like a everyone hates this opinion. They think it's kind of ridiculous that no one is going to be doing on-prem. And then over here, you're thinking like nobody's even thinking about on-prem anymore. Is there a group of people that sort of like are kind of in the middle and would sort of argue with that based on sort of a hand in each side of things?
If you go by, let's just use the US cloud providers for an example. So we're going to try to answer this question based on their actions. Amazon, Microsoft Azure, and Google Cloud. In the Azure case, a lot of their products work on-prem in the form of Azure Stack, right? You can get virtual machines, Hyper-V, and some of their other managed services. If you look at Amazon, they have an offering called Outposts, which they will send you an Amazon rack to put into your own data center and connect it back into their broader cloud network. And then Google Cloud has an offering called Anthos, where a lot of the things that we host in the cloud will run on-premise. And then you would say, wow, those are monumental amounts of engineering effort to allow and make sure that it works, a lot of your cloud portfolio on-premise. So by those actions, you can kind of see that that is something that no one sees happening anytime soon, right? A popular opinion right now is there will always be a need for on-prem, and this is why most cloud providers need to figure out how to get those necessary services to also run on-prem.
But in your opinion, it's ultimately just not worth it, and the cloud is going to swallow up pretty much everything with a few folks kind of holding on until the end?
I would say today it's definitely worth it, to be clear. But if we zoom out 10 years from now, does the cloud not innovate to the point that they could do something that you couldn't do on your own, right? Think about airlines, for example. Probably buy a 2-seater, 4-seater plane and find somewhere to park it. But there is no way many of us would ever become pilots that can fly a 747, right? We don't have the infrastructure for that. So once you start to get to that kind of scale and efficiency, then I think that's a natural evolution that most cloud providers are on. And if we ever get to that part, then it will be very hard to find economic value in trying to replicate the new standard, the new bar on your own. It'll be very expensive, and it may not even be worth it in terms of what you can actually get by using shared infrastructure like we do in other parts of our daily lives.
Well, for anyone listening, and you're still on-prem, perhaps you should consider going to the cloud soon, or 60 years from now, you might be having a call to action on who knows how to do any of this stuff.
There are reports of that where people have lost servers. Like, they literally don't know where the server is. Like, someone quit, and that was the last person who knew which data center they were paying the bill. So all they have is an IP address, and they will call for help, and you reverse engineer where that IP address is, and you will find that data center and say, hey, I think my server's in there. How do I get it back?
Wouldn't it be great if there was a way for all those people who lost their like Bitcoin on their tiny USB drives to be able to map that back?
We asked the community about unpopular opinions in a thread on Dev and got hundreds of replies. There was no shortage of people who wanted to weigh in on this subject. Ironically, anything that kind of rises to the top of the thread is like de facto popular, but it's a kind of good way to find kind of what people want to rail against. So our first response is from Brett Boutel.
I think that engineers are overpaid, and that a lot of the time software engineering work actually isn't valuable and provides very little value to, well, A, to society, and then B, even to companies. So yeah, I don't know if that's unpopular or not, but I have a feeling it would be unpopular.
This opinion is presumably unpopular among software engineers. They sort of have a stake in not thinking this. Kelsey, what do you think about that?
I might fall in that, you know, well-paid category. So I understand it, though, because I think I delivered the most value in my career when I was able to step away from the keyboard and prevent things from being built that shouldn't have been built, understanding the problem, and then being able to communicate the why behind what we're doing. And I think those skills, in aggregate, are like, why are we doing this? If it's to educate a million people, there's a lot of value in that, and it kind of justifies the work that's being done on the keyboard. But I think there is a lot of situations where some people start with the software and then go find the problem. And in that world, I can see where someone would have that opinion. But I definitely think it's unpopular because of the opportunity that software presents. You can solve a problem at scale, even when the software engineer is gone, right? So if I write this software today and it has very little bugs or manageable set of bugs, think about video games, for example. Most video games contain bugs, but most of them are still playable. You can ship millions of copies of that application, aka game, and benefit from years to come, even when the work stops. And I think that's why there's a lot of value at the software engineering layer.
I just want to note that the caller wanted the audience to know that they are an engineer, in case it was just a disgruntled person being mad that engineers get paid well. So I actually can definitely see this caller's perspective. And my assumption is that they're referring to engineers who work in the US or Europe, because there are many countries where software engineering work is, like many would consider, undervalued. So yeah, I think it really depends on where you are right now.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of this weird dynamic where like nobody is getting paid strictly based on the value that they're providing. It's kind of this crapshoot where like, you know, most software development doesn't really pay off, but then like 1% of it pays off like crazy. And it's averaged out on like what people are willing to pay for. But it's going to be interesting to see how much of software development continues to be this kind of like hyper niche field that's kind of hard to break into and few people do it for many, or whether we sort of get into this point where there's a little bit more of a blue collar software development type of industry, or maybe that's already a thing and we just don't call those sort of jobs software development sometimes. But if these private companies are kind of willing to shell out the money, it's kind of hard to stop them.
Yeah. And I think this question is also about relative to what, right? Are teachers not paid enough? Are nurses not paid enough? There's lots of professions that society definitely needs and definitely adds value, which may not be being paid anywhere close to what the average US software engineering salary is. I think that's where that question starts to hold a lot more water, is because we would ask ourselves, relative to these other professions, you know, why should software engineers be paid so much more?
Yeah, I mean, I think especially in this pandemic right now, like I personally have just been thinking about like what is the inherent value of what I do versus people who are really at the front lines supporting everybody who's at home.
Yeah.
Another response that popped out is from Bruno. And Bruno says, I can still be more productive and integrate web apps much faster when using vanilla JS and jQuery than literally any JS framework.
Whew.
I can say that that kind of resonated with me because I'm not coding day to day anymore. And much of the dev code base was in vanilla.js for a long time. I think the bulk of it still is. And so I personally am just more comfortable in vanilla.js than frameworks. Like when we started incorporating Preact into the app, it just like stressed me out a lot.
Yeah, when you don't have dependencies, you sort of know right what's there and know what to do. Like if you get frustrated by build tools, I think this really resonates. You know, if you want to jump right in there and actually kind of see what's in the file and get going with it. But this is probably about like the inherent startup time that like the JavaScript community sort of has. They've replaced sort of get running quickly, just open up your browser, anything works, with like kind of the opposite situation where nothing quite works on its own and everything is like, there's a lot of boilerplate and startup frameworks and stuff like that. And it's hard to say that you're going to be productive down the road with vanilla.js and jQuery compared to literally any framework designed to scale.
Yeah, for me, it's how many browsers do you have to support? And that's where I saw the power in some of those frameworks alone, just working out the differences between the various browsers. And I think that's been the biggest challenge. So if you're very skilled in JavaScript and you know how to do that already, or you only have a limited set of browsers, I think that probably could be true. But I think for a lot of people, the frameworks kind of represent all of those sharp edges kind of hidden and attempting to give you a different dialect so you can focus on the thing you want.
Yeah. Speaking of the dialects that different browsers need. Christina wrote in, well, all they wrote in was Firefox, greater than sign, Chrome, implying that they prefer Firefox over Chrome. And then somebody else, Josh from our team, who is a full-on Apple person, jumped in and said that Safari is a great web browser. What are your preferred browsers?
As a paid Google employee,
let me see the answer is. My non-biased opinion is Google Chrome. To be honest, I was using Chrome before joining Google because there was a point in time when Chrome was the underdog. And Chrome's philosophy, and it still holds to today, is around a lot of these web standards. And a lot of those web standards, I think Chrome really pushed forward in favor of things like Flash and some of the other technologies back then, ActiveX being another one of those. And I think Chrome has did a decent job of keeping their momentum high, so much so that like Microsoft has even, you know, re-platformed their browser on top of Chrome. So I would probably say just being a Chrome user for so long, I have an affinity towards it.
I once made a tweet that was said nice things about Safari and discovered quickly how unpopular that opinion was. It's kind of a hard conversation because we want to support browser diversity. I think there's a lot of heartache when Edge went with Chromium. You know, whether or not that was like immediately better for the end user, probably was. But kind of hard to separate sort of like opinions from like the underlying ecosystem and stuff like that. Like, you know, what people want the web to be like. I've recently adopted Firefox from Chrome just when I changed computers, thinking I wanted to try something new. I thought it would also help me gain more awareness about the different ways different browsers react kind of as an end user to get like, so I don't just do it when I'm testing stuff. I've been really happy with Firefox. I really hope it continues to progress, continues to do well. I hope it, you know, hope it succeeds and keeps finding users and maybe being the more like, you know, the better choice for a lot of folks. While Chrome is still kind of really, really well positioned and really well built and thought out, and obviously has Google behind it.
I will admit though, I do use Safari when reading on the web. Right, they have a little button you can click that just hides everything and lets you just focus on this kind of minimalist like set of text and you can just read.
Christina also essentially said the same thing as Bruno in the CSS world. They said that CSS, especially Flexbox or Grid, is 100 times easier than figuring out Bootstrap or other frameworks. And I think that's kind of pretty easy to agree with as well, except with the caveat that you're also going to give up a lot of browser support in doing that. And kind of the same argument, Kelsey, you were making on the JavaScript side.
Yeah, I found myself about 2 years ago struggling to center a website still. And I don't know if that was
classic,
more about me or the state of web design still, that is still the thing that isn't super obvious on how to do.
Yeah.
Well, on the note of CSS, Ben Holmes wrote in and said, I prefer writing raw CSS to using Sass. Yes, I'd rather lose nested styles and mix-ins over adding an extra second to my build time. Sue me.
So far, like, this is all of these opinions are just a radical backlash against building anything.
So an unpopular opinion should be like, computers were a mistake. Was this all worth it? Right? Like, if we were to have a retrospective and say, was introducing computers to humanity worth it? And I think that would be unpopular because so much of our daily lives, there's a computer involved. And I think that's where you start to get into the, you know, something that has enough meat on it to kind of debate and probably, yeah, that would probably be unpopular if you went around and said, all right, we're taking all the computers back.
It's an extreme one. Very difficult to imagine the world as it is today without computers. If we're looking for more extreme opinions, Diane wrote in and said, Swift is one of the worst languages, with a hardly functioning tool chain and a language full of inconsistencies, and it lacks a shit ton of basic features. Objective-C, in comparison, it is much cleaner and well-structured.
Yeah, tell them how you really feel.
This is funny to me, because I feel like this is a perfectly fine opinion to have, because, you know, like, arguing about languages is kind of like the essence of, like, opinions. But I've tried hard to write Objective-C, and I, like, you know, I can't make it work for my brain. And Swift, it seems just easy. Like, it just kind of, regardless of its, like, properties, it just kind of gets the job done for me. And I really have to think that that makes it a good language. And my issues with Objective-C seem to be just, like, centered around what other languages I've written in and how it just looks different. And it's kind of weird, but I could never get it to click.
Same.
Here's one for Kelsey. Docker and Kubernetes are not solutions to your scalability problems. That's the whole comment.
Ooh, I like this one because this is unpopular with me. It is probably alone not the solution. Agreed. But for a lot of people, if you ask yourself a very honest question, what are you actually building? And without Kubernetes, you're probably building something like Kubernetes or some distributed system. And it's probably not following any particular design, and it might be based on not a lot of experience. So Kubernetes design solves the scalability of the deployment workflow, but it will definitely not solve, like, your app is slow. Yeah, Kubernetes will just deploy a slow app, right? It's not going to turn your thing into a faster application, right? It can't do that because, you know, there's a line there between the data your application receives and the fact that Kubernetes placed your application on a particular server. And I think that's where you have to decouple things. But for a lot of people, there's other parts of dealing with scalability, like knowing how to easily scale something horizontally. So if your app, even if it's a monolith, if you can handle, let's say, 100 requests per second, and you're really struggling to build infrastructure tools that allow you to go from one VM to, let's say, 50, then for some people in that situation, having Kubernetes kind of run on top of maybe 10 machines might give you better tooling of giving you that horizontal scale situation in a more consistent way than writing a bunch of scripts or bringing in maybe 5 or 6 different tools to attempt to do the same. So this is why I think a lot of people, even if their code didn't get any better, they felt like bringing in Kubernetes gave them this perceived value of, wow, I can now manage to scale horizontally.
Yeah, I got to think this is the kind of opinion which Bhavani is sort of sharing, like, at someone else they've been in an argument with because they're trying to use Kubernetes wrong or something, like, where if everyone was kind of on the same page about what the whole purpose was in the first place, they wouldn't have disagreed on the scalability issues.
Yeah, there's a lot of people, if I ask, what is Kubernetes? And they draw a blank. So it really hurts the rest of the argument, right? If you think Kubernetes is like an application platform that will change the way you write software, it's not quite that. And that's why I think a lot of people, if you go in with that expectation, you will be definitely disappointed because you still have to write the software yourself.
I think once technologies transcend into the point where, like, most people know the name, but there's still a lagging of kind of people using the software or, like, actually kind of understanding the problems they're facing, like, there becomes this kind of name drop syndrome, and Kubernetes definitely is sort of ripe in that territory.
So this next one is from David Eddy, and they wrote in, "There is no such thing as junior DevOps." I thought this was really interesting because when I had just gone out of the boot camp, I had a fork in the road where I was working as a product manager, but they were looking for an additional person on their DevOps team. And I had the option of going down that route, which was really enticing at the time because I didn't really feel like there was anywhere you could learn DevOps. Like, that's not something they bring up in boot camps. So yeah, I'm curious, like, what it would mean to be junior DevOps and whether or not you all think that's possible.
So I actually have a different opinion. There's no such thing as DevOps. But that, we'll save that one for a second, because what does that even mean? I think there is going to always be a place for people to start. That has to remain universally true, or we're in trouble. So that, to me, is kind of this kind of gatekeeper philosophy, right? Like, if you're not as good as I am, even though I got to be a beginner once, you don't. Like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, that doesn't really add up too much. And maybe that's not even what they're saying. But I think when you start to think about, when we use this term DevOps, there's a lot of skills that go beyond technical abilities. And a lot of them are based on experience, right? Like, how to communicate how to work and collaborate with others. And all of those skills, I do believe, can be taught and learned if you're willing. So when you're new to the field, the hard part is being able to contribute at whatever the expectation is of all of those attributes on day one, because you may have never done it before, right? So you're going to have to ramp up a little bit. And the thing that I do see a lot is there are people who have been practicing quote unquote DevOps for like 10 years, and they're still at the junior level. They're not actually good at it. They've just been doing the same 6 months worth of experience for 10 years. They download a bunch of software from the internet that have DevOps somewhere in the mention and believe that you can solve a lot of this with tooling, but they may not say that directly. They may say it's about all these other things. And you ask, are you doing those other things? Are you even good at those other things? And show me the results. And a lot of people in our industry struggle with the results part. In that case, it's a person that has 10 years, 6 months experience.
Yeah, it's hard to tell what exactly the next part of this comment is. Like, what does it mean that there's no such thing as junior DevOps? Does that mean, you know, like if you do DevOps, you're not junior just because you're doing ops and then you kind of have to be doing like something that touches operations? I don't know. But the ops part of DevOps, you know, it's all so context specific, like solving company problems, like doing ops the way the company needs it to be done. And on that level, like we have a team, you know, within our small organization called ops, which doesn't have anything to do with dev. It's just like, you know, organizing the team and doing operations and stuff. And I feel like the folks who do that kind of work, they're like one step away from being able to do DevOps if they just kind of wanted to be oriented that way, because it's so based on like organizational structure. So I don't know exactly what they're trying to get at here, but I see the kind of ops thing like as just a function of how the organization solves problems at all. And ours, you know, like as we grow, it seems like it's more and more ops and less just strictly product and stuff like that. And even strictly kind of the dev side of things. It's like an interesting thing. I could see like any kind of path into ops, and it's definitely a lot less clear than into sort of other parts of development.
Yeah, if you just drop DevOps and this designation of what junior means, then you can actually get somewhere, because there, like I said, junior does not really mean much other than, I hope, someone that's willing to learn and is honest about what they're learning in a particular area. I think sometimes we use a blanket statement like this person just is junior in life. There are some people who have lots of other valuable experience, but they're learning a new technology, and that doesn't represent the whole person.
Yeah, absolutely. I could not agree more with that statement. Let's wrap it up with this next response from Nadia. They say, I will make tons of enemies with this statement, but for me, mechanical keyboards should be banned from offices. In my dev room, we're up to 20 people, and 19 of us, so not me, have a mechanical keyboard. The noise is very annoying, especially when my fellow coworkers go berserk and start to tap on those damn keyboards at the speed of light. I put my headphones on, but I cannot listen to loud music 8 hours straight every day.